I'm not going to go into this. You were nuts. You could have killed us both. One night you got matches and tried to set the house on fire, remember that?
I was just joking,
I said uneasily. And the carpet? Big burned hole in the sofa? Was that a joke? I turned the cushion so that Zandra wouldn't see it. That piece of shit was so cheap it wasn't even flame retardant.
Right, right. Have it your way.
Anyway, this one night, we are watching Dr. No, which I had never seen but you had. And I was liking it very much, and you are completely Vegania. And it's on his island and all cool. And he presses the button and shows that picture he stole?
Oh, God.
Boris cackled.
You did? God help you, it was great. So drunk, you are staggering. I have something to show you. Something wonderful. Best thing ever.
Stepping in front of the television.
No, really.
Me, watching movie? Best part? You wouldn't shut up?
Fuck off. Anyway, off you go, mad as hell. Fuck you. Making all this noise, bang, bang, bang. And then, down you come with the picture, see?
He laughed.
Funny thing. Was sure you were bullshitting me. World-famous museum work? Give me a break.
But it was real. Anyone could see.
I don't believe you.
Well, it's true. I did know. Because if possible to paint fakes that look like that, Las Vegas would be the most beautiful city in the history of Earth.
Anyway, so funny.
Here I am, so proudly teaching you to steal apples and candy from the magazine, while you have stolen world masterpiece of art.
I didn't steal it.
Boris chuckled.
No, no, you explained. Preserving it in safety. Big important duty in life.
You're telling me, he said, leaning forward, you really haven't opened it up and looked at it? All these years? What is the matter with you?
I don't believe you, I said again.
When did you take it?
I said when he rolled his eyes away from me.
How?
Look, like I said,
how do you expect me to believe one word of this?
Boris rolled his eyes again. He reached in his coat pocket. He punched up a picture on his iPhone. Then he handed it across the table to me. It was the verso of the painting. You could find a reproduction of the front anywhere, but the back was as distinctive as a fingerprint. Rich drips of sealing wax, brown and red. Irregular patchwork of European labels, Roman numerals, spidery, quilled signatures, which had the feeling of a steamer trunk or some international treaty of long ago. The crumbling yellows and browns were layered with an almost organic richness, like dead leaves. He put the phone back in his pocket. We sat for a long while in silence. Then Boris reached for a cigarette.
Believe me now?
He said, blowing a stream of smoke out the side of his mouth. The atoms in my head were spinning apart. The sparkle of the bump had already begun to turn. Apprehension and disquiet, moving in subtly like dark air before a thunderstorm. For a long, somber moment we looked at each other. High chemical frequency, solitude to solitude, like two Tibetan monks on a mountaintop. Then I stood without a word and got my coat. Boris jumped up too.
Wait, he said as I shouldered past him. Potter, don't go angry.
When I said I would make it up to you, I meant it. Potter,
he called again as I stepped through the clattering bead curtain and out onto the street, into the dirty gray light of dawn. Avenue C was empty except for a solitary cab which seemed to be as glad to see me as I was to see it, and darted over to stop for me immediately. Before he could say another word, I got in and drove off and left him there, standing in his overcoat by a bank of trash cans. 10. It was 8:30 in the morning by the time I got to storage, with a sore jaw from grinding my teeth and a heart about to explode. Bureaucratic daylight, pedestrian morning blaring, bright with threat. By 9:45, I was sitting on the floor of my room at Hobie's house with my mind reeling like a spun-down top, wobbling and veering from side to side. Strewn on the carpet around me were a pair of shopping bags, a never-used pup tent, a beige percale pillowcase that still smelled like my bedroom in Vegas, a tin full of assorted Roxycondons and Morphs I knew I ought to flush, and a snarl of packing tape into which I'd cut painstakingly with an X-Acto knife. 20 minutes of delicate work, pulse throbbing in my fingertips, terrified of going in too hard and nicking the painting by mistake. Finally getting the side open, peeling the tape off strip by strip by careful strip, with trembling hands, only to find, sandwiched in cardboard and wrapped with newspaper, a scribbled up civics workbook. Democracy, diversity, and you. Bright multicultural throng. On the cover, Asian kids, Latino kids, African-American kids, Native American kids. A girl in a Muslim headscarf and a white kid in a wheelchair smiled and held hands before an American flag. Inside, within the book's cheery, dull world of good citizenship, where persons of different ethnicities all participated happily in their communities, and inner-city kids stood around their housing project with a watering can, caring for a potted tree with branches illustrating the different branches of government, Boris had drawn daggers with his name on them, roses and hearts surrounding Kotku's initials, and a set of spying eyes peeping slyly to one side above a partially filled-out sample test. Why does man need government? To impose ideology, punish wrongdoers, and promote equality and brotherhood among peoples. What are some duties of an American citizen? To vote for Congress, celebrate diversity, and fight the enemies of the state. Hobie, thankfully, was out. The pills I'd swallowed hadn't worked, and after 2 hours of twisting and flopping on my bed in a torturous, falling, half-dream state, thoughts flying, exhausted from my heart beating so fast, Boris's voice still running through my mind, I forced myself to get up, clear the mess strewn round my bedroom, and shower and shave, nicking myself in the process, since my upper lip was almost dentist chair numb from the nosebleed I'd suffered. Then I made myself a pot of coffee, found a stale scone in the kitchen and forced myself to eat it, and was down in the shop and open for business by noon, just in time to intercept the mail lady in her plastic rain poncho, looking a bit alarmed, standing well back from roomy-eyed me with my cut lip and my bloody Kleenex. Although as she was handing the mail over to me with latex-gloved hands, I realized, what was the point? Reeve could write Hobie all he wanted. Phone Interpol. Who cared anymore? It was raining. Pedestrians huddled and scurrying. Rain pelting hard at the window. Rain beating on the plastic garbage bags at the curb. There at my desk, in my musty armchair, I tried to anchor myself or at least take some kind of comfort in the faded silks and dimness of the shop, its bittersweet gloom like rainy, dark classrooms of childhood. But the dopamine slam had dropped me hard and left me with the pre-tremblings of something that felt very like death. A sadness you felt in your stomach first, beating on the inside of the forehead. All the darkness I'd shut out roaring back in. Tunnel vision. All those years I drifted along too glassy and insulated for any kind of reality to push through. A delirium which had spun me along on its slow, relaxed waves since childhood. High and lying on the shag carpet in Vegas, laughing at the ceiling fan. Only I wasn't laughing anymore. Rip Van Winkle wincing and holding his head on the ground, about 100 years too late. What way was there to make it okay? None. In a way, Boris had done me a favor by taking the thing. At least, I knew that was how most people would see it. I was off the hook. No one could blame me. The greater part of my problems had been solved at a stroke. But while I knew that any sane person would be relieved to have the painting off their hands, yet I'd never felt quite so scorched with despair, self-hatred, shame. Warm, weary shop. I could not stay still. I stood up and sat down, walked to the window and back again. Everything was sodden with horror. A bisque pulcinella eyed me with spite. Even the furniture looked sickly and disproportionate. How could I have believed myself a better person, a wiser person, a more elevated and valuable and worthy of living person on the basis of my secret uptown. Yet I had. The painting had made me feel less mortal, less ordinary. It was support and vindication. It was sustenance and sum. It was the keystone that had held the whole cathedral up. And it was awful to learn, by having it so suddenly vanish from under me, that all my adult life I'd been privately sustained by that great, hidden, savage joy. The conviction that my whole life was balanced atop a secret that might at any moment blow it apart. 11. When Hobie got home, around 2, he walked in off the street with a jingle of bells like a customer.
"Well, that was certainly a surprise last night."
He was pink-cheeked from the rain, shrugging off his raincoat and shaking the water off. He was dressed for the auction house, Windsor knotted tie and one of the beautiful old suits.
"Boris."
He'd done well at his auction, I could tell by his mood. Though he tended not to go in with strong bids, he knew what he wanted, and every so often in a slow session, when no one was up against him, he made off with a pile of beauties.
"I gather you two made quite a night of it?"
I was hunched in a corner, sipping tea. My headache was ferocious.
"Funny to meet him after hearing so much about him. Like meeting a character in a book. I'd always pictured him as the artful dodger in Oliver. Oh, you know, the little boy, the urchin. What's the actor's name? Jack something. Ragged coat, smear of dirt along the cheek."
Believe me, he was dirty enough back then.
"Well, you know, Dickens doesn't tell us what happened to the dodger. Grew up to be a respectable businessman, who knows? And wasn't Popper out of his mind? I've never seen an animal so happy." "Oh, and yes,"
half turning, busy with his coat, he hadn't noticed me go still at Popper's name.
"Before I forget, Kitsy called."
I didn't answer. I couldn't. I hadn't thought of Popper even once.
"Late-ish, 10. Told her you'd run into Boris. You'd come by, you'd gone out. Hope that was all right."
"Sure," I said after an effortful pause, struggling to collect my thoughts, which were galloping in several very bad directions at once.
"What must I remind you?"
Hobie put his finger to his lips.
"I was given a charge. Let me think. I can't remember," he said after a small start, shaking his head. "You'll have to phone her. Dinner tonight, I know. It's someone's house. Dinner at 8. That I remember. But I can't remember where."
"The Long Streets," I said, my heart plunging.
"That sounds right. Anyhow, Boris, great fun, great charmer. How long's he in town for? How long's he here for?"
he repeated amiably when I didn't answer. He couldn't see my face, staring out horrified into the street.
"We should have him over for dinner, don't you think? Why don't you ask him to give us a couple of nights when he's free? That is, if you like," he said, when I didn't reply. "Up to you. Let me know."
12. About 2 hours later, exhausted, eyes streaming with pain from my headache, I was still frantically wondering how to get Popper back, while simultaneously inventing and rejecting explanations for his absence. I left him tied in front of a store. Someone had snatched him. An obvious lie. Quite apart from the fact that it was pouring rain, Popper was so old and cranky on the leash, I could hardly drag him down to the fire hydrant. Groomer? Popper's groomer, a needy-seeming old lady named Cecilia who worked out of her apartment, always had him back by 3. Vet? Quite apart from the fact that Popper wasn't sick, and why wouldn't I have mentioned it if he was? Popper went to the same vet that Hobie had known since the days of Welty and Chessy. Dr. McDermott's office was right down the street. Why would I have taken him anywhere else? I groaned, got up, walked to the window. Again and again I ran against the same dead end, Hobie walking in befuddled, as he was bound to do in an hour or two, looking around the store.
"Where's Popper? Have you seen him?"
And that was it. infinite loop, no Alt-Tab out. You could force close, shut down the computer, start all over and run it again, and the game would still lock up and freeze at the same place.
Where's Papa?
No cheat code. Game over. There was no way past that moment. The ragged sheets of rain had slowed to a drizzle, shining sidewalks and water dripping from the awnings, and everyone on the street seemed to have seized the moment to throw on a raincoat and dash out to the corner with their dogs. Dogs everywhere I looked, galumphing sheepdog, black standard poodle, terrier mutts, retriever mutts, an elderly French bulldog and a self-satisfied pair of dachshunds with their chins in the air, prissing in tandem across the street. In agitation, I went back to my chair, sat down, picked up the Christie's house sale catalog, and began to leaf through it in an agitated way. Horrible modernist watercolors. $2,000 for an ugly Victorian bronze of two buffaloes fighting. Absurd. What was I going to tell Hobie? Popper was old and deaf, and sometimes he fell asleep in out-of-the-way places where he didn't hear right away when we called. But soon enough it would be time for his dinner, and I would hear Hobie walking around upstairs, looking for him behind the sofa, and in Pippa's bedroom, and all his usual places.
Popsky! Here, boy! Dinner time!
Could I feign ignorance? Pretend to search the house, too? Scratch my head in puzzlement? Mysterious disappearance? Bermuda Triangle? I'd returned, with sinking heart, to the groomer idea when the shop bell jingled.
I started to keep him.
Popper, damp but otherwise looking none the worse for his adventure, stiffened his legs rather formally as Boris set him down on the floor and then paddled over to me, holding his head up so that I might scratch him under the chin.
He did not miss you one bit, said Boris. We had a very nice day together.
What'd you do? I said, after a very long silence, because I couldn't think of anything else to say.
Sleeped, mostly. Guri dropped us off.
He scrubbed his darkened eyes and yawned.
And we had a very nice nap together, the two of us. You know, how he used to curl up, like a fur hat on my head.
Popper had never liked to sleep with his chin on my head like that, only with Boris.
Then we woke up, and I had a shower, and I took him for a walk. Not far, he did not want to go far. And I made some phone calls, and we ate a bacon sandwich, and drove back in. Look, I am sorry, he said impulsively when I didn't answer, running his hand through his rumpled hair. Really? And I'm going to make it right again, and good. I will.
The silence between us was crushing.
Did you have fun last night, anyway? I had fun. Big night out.
Not feeling so hot this morning, though.
Please say something,
he blurted when I didn't reply.
I have been feeling very, very bad about this all day.
Popper had snuffled across the room to his water dish. Peacefully, he began to drink. For a long time, there was no sound except his monotonous lapping and slurping.
Really, Theo, hand to heart, I feel terrible. My feelings, my shame, I have no words for,
he said more gravely when still I did not answer.
And yes, I'll admit it. Part of me asks myself, why did you wreck everything, Boris? Why did you open your big mouth? But how could I lie and sneak? You'll give me that, at least,
he said, rubbing his hands agitatedly.
I am not cowardly. I told you. I admitted it. I didn't want you to worry, not knowing what was going on. And I am going to make it up to you somehow, I promise. Why?
Hobie was busy downstairs with the vacuum, but I lowered my voice all the same. The same angry whisper when Zandra was downstairs and we didn't want her to hear us quarreling.
Why? Why what? Why the hell did you take it?
Boris blinked, a bit self-righteously.
Because you have Jewish mafia coming to your house is why. No, that's not why.
Boris sighed.
Well, is partly why, a little. Was it safe at your house? No. And not at school, either. Got my old school book, wrapped it in newspaper, and taped it, same fatness.
I asked you why did you take it. What can I say? I am thief. Popper was still noisily slurping up the water. With exasperation, I wondered if Boris had thought to put a bowl down for him in their so nice day out.
And?
Lightly he shrugged.
I wanted it.
Yes.
Who would not?
Wanted it? Why? For money? I said when he didn't answer. Boris made a face.
Of course not. Can't sell something like that.
Although, must admit, one time I was in trouble 4 or 5 years ago, I almost sold it outright, low, low price, giveaway almost, just to be rid of it.
Glad I did not. I was in a jam and I needed cash, but,
sniffing hard, wiping his nose,
trying to sell piece like that is the quickest way to get caught. You know that yourself. As negotiable instrument, different story. They hold it as collateral, they front you the goods. You sell the goods, whatever, return with the capital, give them their cut. Picture is returned to you. Game over. Understand?
I said nothing. Began to leaf through my Christie's catalog again, which was still lying open on my desk.
You know what they say.
His voice both sad and cajoling.
Chance makes the thief.
Who knows that better than you? I went in your locker looking for lunch money and I thought,
what? Hello, what's this? It was easy to slip it out and hide it.
And then I took my old workbook to Kotko's shop class, same size, same thickness, same tape and everything. Kotko helped me do it. I didn't tell her why I was doing it, though. You couldn't really tell Kotko things like that.
I still can't believe you stole it.
Look, I'm not going to make excuses. I took it.
But,
he smiled winningly,
am I dishonest? Did I lie about it?
Yes, I said after a disbelieving pause.
Yes, you did lie about it.
You never asked me straight out. If you did, I would have told you. Boris, that's bullshit. You lied.
Well, I'm not lying now,
said Boris, looking around resignedly.
I thought you would have found out by now.
Years ago. I thought that you knew it was me.
I wandered away to the stairs, trailed by Popchik. Hobie had shut the vacuum cleaner off, leaving a glaring silence, and I didn't want him to hear us.
I am not too clear.
Boris blew his nose sloppily, inspected the contents of the Kleenex,
winced. But am fairly sure it is in Europe somewhere.
He wadded the Kleenex and stuffed it in his pocket.
Genoa, outside chance? But my best guess is Belgium or Germany. Holland, maybe. They will be able to negotiate with it better because people are more impressed with it over there.
That doesn't really narrow it down a lot.
Well, listen, be glad it is not in South America, because then I guarantee no chance you would see it again.
I thought you said it was gone.
I am not saying anything, except I think I may be able to learn where it is.
May. That is very different from knowing how to get it back. I have not dealt with these people before at all.
What people? Boris, uneasily, remained silent, casting his eyes about on the floor. Iron bulldog figurines, stacked books, many little carpets.
He doesn't pee on all the antiquities?
He inquired, nodding at Popchik.
All this nice furniture?
Nope.
He used to go all the time in your house. Your whole carpet downstairs smelled like pee. I think maybe because Zandra was not so good about taking him out before we got there.
What people?
Huh?
What people have you not dealt with?
It's complicated. I will explain to you if you want,
he added hastily. Only I think we are both tired, and now is not the time.
But I'm going to make a few calls and tell you what I find, right? And when I do, I will come back and tell you, promise.
By the way,
tapping his upper lip with his finger.
What?
I said, startled.
Spot there, under your nose.
I cut myself shaving.
Oh. Standing there, he looked uncertain, as if he were on the verge of rushing in with some much more heated apology or outburst. But the silence that hung between us had a decidedly conclusive air, and he shoved his hands in his pockets.
Well.
Well.
See you later, then.
Sure. But when he walked out the door, and I stood at the window and watched him duck the drips from the awning and saunter away, his gait loosening and lightening as soon as he thought he was out of my view, I felt there was a pretty good chance it was the last I'd see of him. 13. Given how I felt, which was near death, basically, suffering from an ugly migrainous headache and engulfed with such misery I could barely see, there was little point keeping the shop open. So though the sun had come out and people were appearing on the street, I turned around the closed sign and, with Popper trundling anxiously behind me, I dragged myself upstairs, half sick with the pain hammering behind my eyes, to pass out for a few hours before dinner. Kitsy and I were to meet at her mother's apartment at 7:45 before heading over to the Long Streets, but I arrived a little early, partly because I wanted to see her on her own for a few minutes before we went to dinner, partly because I had something for Mrs. Barber. A rare-ish exhibition catalog I'd found for her in one of Hobie's estate lots. Printmaking in the age of Rembrandt. No, no, said Etta when I went to the kitchen to ask her to knock on the door for me. She's up and about. I took her some tea not 15 minutes ago. What up and about meant, for Mrs. Barber, was pajamas and puppy-chewed slippers with what looked like an old opera coat thrown over.
Oh, Theo,
she said, her face opening with a touching, unguarded plainness that made me think of Andy on the rare occasions when he was actually happy about something, such as his Nagler 22mm telescopic eyepiece arriving in the mail, or his happy discovery of the LARP, live-action role-play, porn site, featuring busty, sword-wielding lasses, getting it on with knights and wizards and so forth.
What a dear, dear duck you are.
You don't have it, I hope.
No,
leafing through it delightedly.
How perfect of you. You'll never, ever believe it, but I saw this show in Boston back when I was in college.
That must have been some show, I said, settling back into an armchair. I was feeling much happier than an hour previous I would have thought possible. Sick over the painting, sick with headache, despairing at the thought of dinner with the Long Streets, wondering how the hell I was going to make it through an evening of hot crab dip and Forrest delivering his views on the economy, when all I basically wanted to do was blow my brains out. I'd tried to call Kitsy with the intention of begging her to plead illness with me so we could skive off and spend the evening at her apartment, in bed. But, as often happened, infuriatingly, on Kitsy's days out, my calls had gone unreturned, my texts and emails unanswered, my messages clicking straight through to voicemail.
I need to get a new phone,
she'd said fretfully when I'd complained of these all-too-frequent communication blackouts.
There's something wrong with it.
And though I'd asked her several times to walk in off the street with me to the Apple store and get a new one, she always had an excuse. Lines too long, had to be somewhere, wasn't in the mood, hungry, thirsty, needed to pee, couldn't we do it another time? Sitting on the side of my bed with eyes closed, annoyed at not being able to reach her, as I never seemed to be able to do when I really needed to, I'd thought of calling Forrest and telling him I was ill. But as bad as I felt, I still wanted to see her, even if it was only across the table at dinner with people I didn't like. Hence, to force myself out of bed, uptown, and through the most deathly part of the evening, I'd swallowed what had been, for me, in the old days, a mild dose of opiates. But though it hadn't knocked my headache out, it had put me in a surprisingly good mood. I hadn't felt so well in months.
You and Kitsy are dining out tonight?
Said Mrs. Barber, who was still happily leafing through the catalog I'd brought.
Forrest Longstreet?
That's right.
He was in your class with Andy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
He wasn't one of those boys who was so awful.
Well, euphoria had made me generous. Not really. Forrest, oafish and slow on the draw.
Sir, are trees considered plants?
Had never been intelligent enough to persecute Andy and me in any kind of focused or resourceful way. But, yes, you're right, he was part of that whole group, you know, Temple and Tharp and Kavanaugh and Sheffernan.
Yes, Temple. I certainly remember him. And the cable boy.
What? I said, mildly surprised.
He's certainly turned out badly, she said without looking up from the catalog. Living on credit. Can't hold a job. And also some trouble with the law, I hear. Wrote some bad checks. Apparently his mother had a hard time keeping the people from pressing charges. And Wynne Temple, she said, looking up, before I could explain that Cable hadn't really been a part of that aggressive jock crowd. He was the one who knocked Andy's head against the wall in the showers.
Yes, that was him. What I mainly remembered about the showers was not so much Andy getting concussed on the tile as Sheffernan and Kavanaugh wrestling me down and trying to shove a stick of deodorant up my ass. Mrs. Barber, wrapped delicately in her coat, shawl over her lap as if riding in a sleigh to a Christmas party, was still leafing through her book.
Do you know what that Temple boy said?
Sorry?
The Temple boy.
Her eyes were on the book. Her voice was bright, as if she were speaking to a stranger at a cocktail party.
What his excuse was, when they asked why he knocked Andy unconscious.
No, I don't know.
He said, because that kid gets on my nerves. He's an attorney now, they tell me. I certainly hope he holds his temper a bit better in the courtroom.
Wynne wasn't the worst of them, I said after a languid pause, not by a long shot. Now Kavanaugh and Sheffernan.
The mother wasn't even listening, texting away on her cell phone, some terribly urgent matter with a client.
I looked at the cuff of my shirt. I'd taken care to change into a fresh one after work. If there was one thing my opiated years had taught me, not to mention my years of antiques fraud, starched shirts and suits fresh from the cleaners went a long, long way toward hiding a multitude of sins. But I'd been loopy and careless from the morphine tabs, drifting around my bedroom and humming to Elliot Smith as I dressed. Sunshine, been keeping me up for days. And, I noticed, one of my cuffs wasn't done up properly. Moreover, the knots I'd chosen weren't even a matched pair. One black, the other blue.
We could have sued,
said Mrs. Barber absent-mindedly.
I don't know why we didn't. Chance said he thought it would make things harder for Andy at school.
Well, there was no way I could inconspicuously do up my cuff again. It would have to wait for the cab. That thing in the shower was really Sheffernan's fault.
Yes, that's what Andy said. And the Temple boy, too. But as for the actual blow, the concussion, there was no question.
Sheffernan was a sneaky guy. He pushed Andy into Temple. Sheffernan was across the locker room and laughing his head off with Kavanaugh and those guys by the time the fight started.
Well, I don't know about that, but David.
David was Sheffernan's real name.
He wasn't a bit like the others. Always perfectly nice, so polite. We had him over here a good bit, and always so good about including Andy. You know how a lot of the children were, with birthday parties.
Yes, but Sheffernan had it in for Andy, always. Because Sheffernan's mother was always forcing Andy down his throat, making him ask Andy, making him come over here. Mrs. Barber sighed and set down her cup. The tea was jasmine. I could smell it where I sat.
Well, goodness knows you knew Andy better than I did,
she said unexpectedly, drawing the embroidered collar of her wrap closer.
I never saw him for who he was, and in some ways, he was my favorite child. I wish I hadn't been always trying to make him into someone else. Certainly you were always able to accept him on his own terms more than his father and I, or God knows, his brother.
Look, she said in much the same tone, in the rather chilling silence that followed this. She was still leafing through the book.
Here's St. Peter, turning the little children away from Christ.
Obediently, I got up and circled behind. I knew the work, one of the great stormy dry points at the Morgan, the 100 guilder print, as it was called, the price that Rembrandt himself, according to legend, had been forced to pay to buy it back.
He's so particular, Rembrandt. Even his religious subjects. It's as if the saints came down to model for him in the life. These two St. Peters,
she gestured to her own little pen and ink on the wall,
completely different works, and years apart, but the identical man, body and soul. You could pick him out of a lineup, couldn't you? That balding head, same face, dutiful, earnest, goodness written all over him, and yet always that twitch of worry and disquiet, that subtle shade of the betrayer.
Though she was still gazing down at the book, I found myself looking at the silver-framed photo of Andy and his father on the table beside us. It was only a snapshot, but for a sense of foreshadowing, of transience and doom, no master of Dutch genre painting could have set up the composition more skillfully. Andy and Mr. Barber against a dark background, snuffed candles in the wall sconces, Mr. Barber's hand on a model ship. The effect could have been no more allegorical or chilling if he'd had his hand on a skull. Above, in lieu of the hourglass beloved by the Dutch Vanitas painters, a stark and slightly sinister clock with Roman numerals. Black hands. 5 minutes to 12. Time running out. Mommy. It was Platt, barging in, stopping cold to see me.
Don't bother knocking, dear, said Mrs. Barber without glancing up from her book. You're always welcome.
Platt goggled at me. Kitsy. He seemed rattled. He dug his hands in the bellows pockets of his field coat.
She's been held up, he said to his mother.
Mrs. Barber looked startled.
Oh, she said.
They looked at each other, and some unspoken something seemed to pass between them. Held up? I asked amiably, looking between them. Where? There was no answer to this. Platt, looking at his mother, opened his mouth and shut it. Rather smoothly, Mrs. Barber put her book aside and said without looking at me,
Well, you know, I slightly think she's out there playing golf today.
Really? I said, mildly surprised. Isn't it bad weather for that?
There's traffic, Platt said eagerly, with a glance at his mother. She's stuck. The expressway is a mess. She's phoned Forrest, he said, turning to me. They're holding dinner.
Maybe, said Mrs. Barber, thoughtfully, after a pause. Maybe you and Theo should go out and have a drink? Yes, she said decisively, to Platt, as if the matter had been settled, folding her hands. I think that's an excellent idea. You two go out and get a drink. And you, she said, turning to me with a smile. What an angel you are. Thank you so much for my book, she said, reaching to clasp my hand. The most wonderful present in the world. But, yes?
Won't she need to come back here and freshen up? I said, after a slightly confused pause.
Sorry?
Both of them were looking at me. If she's playing golf, won't she need to change? She won't want to go to Forrest's in her golfing clothes, I added, looking back and forth between the two of them, and then, when neither of them replied, I don't mind waiting here. Thoughtfully, Mrs. Barber pursed her lips with heavy-looking eyes, and all at once, I got it. She was tired. She hadn't been expecting to have to sit around and entertain me, only she was too polite to say so. Although, I said, standing up self-consciously, it is getting on. I could use a cocktail. Just then, the phone in my pocket, which had been silent all day, chimed loudly, incoming text. Clumsily, I was so exhausted I could hardly figure out where my own pocket was. I fumbled for it. Sure enough, it was Kitsy, jingling with emoji. Hi, Popsy. Running an hour late. Hope I caught you. Forrest and Celia holding dinner. Meet you there 9 p.m. Love you mostest. Kits. Heart X, heart X, heart X, heart. 14. 5 or 6 days later, I still had not fully recovered from my evening with Boris, partly because I was busy with clients, auctions to go to, estates to look at, and partly because I had grueling events with Kitsy nearly every night. Holiday parties, black tie dinner, Pelias et Melisande at the Met, up by 6 every morning and bed well after midnight, one evening out until 2 a.m., scarcely a moment to myself, and even worse, scarcely a moment alone with her, which normally would have driven me crazy, but in the circumstances kept me so submerged and embattled with fatigue that I didn't have much time to think. All week long, I'd been looking forward to Kitsy's Tuesday with her girlfriends. Not because I didn't want to see her, but because Hobie had a dinner out and I was looking forward to being on my own, eating some leftovers from the fridge and going to bed early. But at closing time, 7 p.m., I still had some catching up to do in the shop. A decorator, miraculously, had shown up to inquire about some expensive, out-of-fashion, and impossible-to-sell pewter, which had been gathering dust atop a cabinet since Welty's day. Pewter wasn't something I knew much about, and I was looking for the article I wanted in a back number of Antiques when Boris dashed up from the curb and knocked on the glass door, not 5 minutes after I'd locked up for the day. It was pelting rain. In the ragged downpour, he was a shadow in an overcoat, unrecognizable, but the cadence of his rap was distinct from the old days, when he would circle around the patio at my dad's house and tap briskly for me to let him in. He ducked in and shook himself violently, so the water went flying.
"You want to ride with me uptown?"
he said without preamble. "I'm busy."
"Yes?"
he said in a voice at once so affectionate and exasperated and transparently childishly hurt that I turned from my bookshelf.
"And won't you ask why? I think you might want to come."
"Uptown where?"
"I'm going to talk to some people."
"And that would be about..."
"Yes,"
he said, brightly, sniffling and wiping his nose.
"Exactly. You don't have to come. I was going to bring my boy Tolly, but I thought for several reasons it might be good if you wanted to be there also."
"Popchick, yes, yes,"
he said, stooping to pick up the dog, who had trundled up to greet him.
"Glad to see you too."
"He likes bacon,"
he said to me, scratching Popper behind the ears and rubbing his nose at the back of Popper's neck.
"Do you ever cook bacon for him? Enjoys the bread, too, when he's soaked with grease."
"Talk to who? Who is this?" Boris pushed the dripping hair out of his face.
"Guy I know, named Horst. Old friend of Miriam's. He got stung on this deal, too. Honest, I do not think he can help us. But Miriam suggested might not hurt to talk him again, and I think maybe she's right about that."
15. On the way uptown, in the back of the town car, rain pounding so hard that Guri had to shout for us to hear him.
"What a dog's weather!"
Boris filled me quietly in about Horst.
"Sad, sad story. He is German. Interesting guy. Very intelligent and sensitive. Important family, too. He explained to me once, but I forgot. His dad was part American and left him a load of money, but when his mother remarried..."
Here he named a world-famous industrial name with a dark old Nazi echo.
"Millions. I mean, you can't believe how much money these people have. They are rolling in it. Money out the ass."
"Yep, that's a sad story, all right."
"Well, Horst is a bad junkie. You know me."
Philosophical shrug.
"I don't judge or condemn. Do what you like, I don't care. But Horst? Very sad case. He fell in love with this girl who was on it, and she got him on it too. Took him for everything, and when the money ran out, she left. Horst's family, they have disowned him many years ago. And still he eats his heart out for this awful, rotten girl. Girl, I say, she must be nearly 40 now. Ulrika, her name is. Every time Horst gets a little money, she comes back for a while. Then she leaves him again."
"What does he have to do with it?"
"Horst's associate Sasha set up things with this deal. I meet the guy. He seems okay. What do I know? Horst told me that he had never worked with Sasha's man in person, but I was in a hurry and I didn't go into it the way I should, and..."
He threw up his arms.
"Poof! Miriam was right. She is always right. I should have listened to her."
Water streamed down the windows, quicksilver heavy, sealing us into the car, lights winking and melting around us in a roar that reminded me of when Boris and I used to ride in the back of the Lexus in Vegas, when my dad went through the car wash.
"Horst is usually a bit fussy about who he does business with, so I thought it would be okay. But he is very restrained, you know? Unusual, is what he said. unconventional. Well, what is that supposed to mean?
Then when I get down there, these people are crazy. I mean, like, shooting guns at chickens crazy.
And situations like this, you want it calm and quiet. It was like, have they seen too much TV or something? Like, this is how to act? Normally, in this type situation, everyone is very, very polite, hush, hush, very peaceful.
Miriam said, and she was right,
forget about the guns. What kind of crazy thing is this for these people to keep chickens in Miami? Even a little thing like that. This is jacuzzi neighborhood. Tennis courts, you understand me? Who keeps chickens? You don't want a neighbor phoning in complaint because of chicken noise in the yard. But by that time,
he shrugged, there I was. I was in. I told myself not to worry so much, but turned out I was right.
What happened?
I don't really know. I got half the goods I was promised. Rest coming in a week. That's not untypical. But then they were arrested, and I didn't get the other half, and I didn't get the picture.
Horst would like to find it too. He is out some big green as well.
Anyway, I am hoping he has a bit more information than when we spoke last.
16. Guri left us out in the 60s, not far at all from the barbers.
This is the place? I said, shaking the rain off Hobie's umbrella.
We were out in front of one of the big limestone townhouses off Fifth. Black iron doors, massive lion's head knockers.
Yes, it's his father's place. His other family are trying to get him out legally, but good luck with that, ha!
We were buzzed in, took a cage elevator up to the second floor. I could smell incense, weed, spaghetti sauce cooking. A lanky blonde woman, short-cropped hair and a serene, small-eyed face like a camel, opened the door. She was dressed like a sort of old-fashioned street urchin or newsboy, houndstooth trousers, ankle boots, dirty thermal shirt, suspenders. Perched on the tip of her nose were a pair of wire-rimmed Ben Franklin glasses. Without saying a word to us, she opened the door to us and walked off, leaving us alone in a dim, grimy, ballroom-sized salon, which was like a derelict version of some high-society set from a Fred Astaire movie. High ceilings, crumbling plaster, grand piano, darkened chandelier with half the crystals broken or gone, sweeping Hollywood staircase littered with cigarette butts. Sufi chants droned low in the background.
Allahu, Allahu, Allahu Hak. Allahu, Allahu, Allahu Hak.
Someone had drawn on the wall, in charcoal, a series of life-sized nudes ascending the stairs like frames in a film. And there was very little furniture apart from a ratty futon and some chairs and tables that looked scavenged from the street. Empty picture frames on the wall. A ram's skull. On the television, an animated film flickered and sputtered with epileptic vim, windmilling geometrics intercut with letters and live-action race car images. Apart from that, and the door where the blonde had disappeared, the only light came from a lamp which threw a sharp white circle on melted candles, computer cables, empty beer bottles and butane cans, oil pastels boxed and loose, many catalogue raisonné, books in German and English including Nabokov's Despair and Heidegger's Being and Time with the cover torn off, sketchbooks, art books, ashtrays and burnt tinfoil, and a grubby-looking pillow where drowsed a gray tabby cat. Over the door, like a trophy from some Schwarzwald hunting lodge, a rack of antlers cast distorted shadows that spread and branched across the ceiling with a Nordic, wicked, fairy tale feel. Conversation in the next room. The windows were shrouded with tacked-up bedsheets, just thin enough to let in a diffuse violet glow from the street. As I looked around, forms emerged from the dark and transformed with a dream strangeness. For one thing, the makeshift room divider, consisting of a carpet, sagging tenement style from the ceiling on fishing line, was on closer look a tapestry, and a good one too, 18th century or older, the near twin of an Amiens I'd seen at auction with an estimate of 40,000 pounds. And not all the frames on the wall were empty. Some had paintings in them, and one of them, even in the poor light, looked like a Corot. I was just about to step over for a look when a man who could have been anywhere between 30 and 50 appeared in the door. Worn-looking, rangy, with straight sandy hair combed back from his face, in black punk jeans out at the knee, and a grungy British commando sweater with an ill-fitting suit jacket over it.
"Hello?"
he said to me, quiet British voice with a faint German bite.
"You must be Potter."
And then, to Boris, "Glad you turned up.
You two should stay and hang out. Candy and Niall are making dinner with Ulrika."
Movement behind the tapestry, at my feet, that made me step back quickly. Swaddled shapes on the floor, sleeping bags, a homeless smell.
"Thanks, we can't stay," said Boris, who had picked up the cat and was scratching it behind the ears. "Have some of that wine, though. Thanks."
Without a word, Horst passed his own glass over to Boris and then called into the next room in German. To me, he said,
"You are Dila, right?"
In the glow of the television, his pale, pinned gull's eye shone hard and unblinking.
"Right,"
I said uneasily, and then, "thanks." Another woman, bob-haired and brunette, high black boots, skirt just short enough to show the black cat tattooed on one milky thigh, had appeared with a bottle and two glasses, one for Horst, one for me.
"Danke, darling," said Horst.
To Boris, he said,
"You gentlemen want to do up?"
"Not right now,"
said Boris, who had leaned forward to steal a kiss from the dark-haired woman as she was leaving.
"Was wondering, though, what do you hear from Sasha?"
"Sasha."
Horst sank down on the futon and lit a cigarette. With his ripped jeans and combat boots, he was like a scuffed-up version of some below-the-title Hollywood character actor from the 1940s, some minor Mitiloru Paisha, known for playing tragic violinists and weary, cultivated refugees.
"Ireland is where it seems to lead. Good news, if you ask me."
"That doesn't sound right."
"Nor to me. But I've spoken to people, and so far it checks out."
He spoke with all a junkie's arrhythmic quiet, offbeat, but without the slur.
"So, soon we should know more, I hope."
"Friend of Niall's?"
"No. Niall says he never heard of them. But it's a start."
The wine was bad. Supermarket Syrah. Because I did not want to be anywhere near the bodies on the floor, I drifted over to inspect a group of artists' casts on a beat-up table. A male torso. A draped Venus leaning against a rock. A sandaled foot. In the poor light, they looked like the ordinary plaster casts for sale at Pearl Paint, studio pieces for students to sketch from. But when I drew my finger across the top of the foot, I felt the suppleness of marble, silky and grainless.
"Why would they go to Ireland with it?"
Boris was saying restlessly.
"What kind of collector's market? I thought everyone tries to get pieces out of there, not in." "Yes, but Sasha thinks he used the picture to clear a debt."
"So the guy has ties there?"
"Evidently." "I find this difficult to believe."
"What, about the ties?"
"No, about the debt. This guy, he looks like he was stealing hubcaps off the street 6 months ago."
Horst shrugged, faintly. Sleepy eyes, seamed forehead.
"Who knows? Not sure that's correct, but certainly I'm not willing to trust to luck. Would I let my hand be cut off for it?"
he said, lazily tapping an ash on the floor.
"No."
Boris frowned into his wine glass.
"He was amateur, believe me. If you saw him yourself, you would know."
"Yes, but he likes to gamble, Sasha says."
"You don't think Sasha maybe knows more?"
"I think not." There was a remoteness in his manner, as if he was talking half to himself.
"Wait and see. This is what I hear. An unsatisfactory answer.
stinking from the top, if you ask me. But, as I say, we are not to the bottom of this yet.
And when does Sasha get back to the city?
The half-light in the room sent me straight back to childhood, Vegas, like the obscure mood of a dream lingering after sleep. Haze of cigarette smoke, dirty clothes on the floor, Boris's face white then blue in the flicker of the screen.
Next week, I'll give you a ring. You can talk to him yourself then.
Yes, but I think we should talk to him together.
Yes, I think so too. They'll both be smarter in future. This need not have happened.
But, in any case,
said Horst, who was scratching his neck slowly, absent-mindedly,
you understand I'm wary of pushing him too hard. That is very convenient for Sasha.
You have suspicions? Tell me.
I think...
Boris cut his eyes at the doorway.
Yes?
I think...
Boris lowered his voice.
You are being too easy on him. Yes, yes,
putting up his hands.
I know. But all very convenient for his guy to vanish, not a clue. He knows nothing.
Well, maybe, Horst said. He seemed disconnected and partly elsewhere, like an adult in the room with small children.
This is pressing on me, on all of us. I want to get to the bottom of this as much as you. Though for all we know, his guy was a cop.
No, said Boris resolutely. He was not. He was not, I know it.
Well, to be quite frank with you, I do not think so either. There is more to this than we know. Still, I'm hopeful.
He'd taken a wooden box from the drafting table and was poking around in it.
Sure you gentlemen wouldn't like to get into a little something?
I looked away. I would have liked nothing better. I would also have liked to see the Corot, except I didn't want to walk around the bodies on the floor to do it. Across the room I'd noticed several other paintings propped on the wainscoting. A still life, a couple of small landscapes.
Go look, if you want.
It was Horst.
The Lépine is fake, but the Clates and the Berkham are for sale, if you are interested.
Boris laughed and reached for one of Horst's cigarettes.
He's not in the market.
No,
said Horst genially.
I can give him a good price on the pair. The seller needs to get rid of them.
I stepped in to look. Still life. Candle and half-empty wine glass.
Klaus Haider?
No, Pieter. Although...
Horst put the box aside, then stood beside me and lifted the desk lamp on the cord, washing both paintings in a harsh, formal glare.
This bit, traced midair with the curve of a finger. The reflection of the flame here, and the edge of the table, the drapery, could almost be Haider on a bad day.
Beautiful piece.
Yes, beautiful of its type.
Up close he smelled unwashed and raunchy, with a strong, dusty import shop odor like the inside of a Chinese box.
A bit prosaic to the modern taste, the classicizing manner, much too staged. Still, the Berkham is very good.
Lot of fake Berkhams out there, I said neutrally.
Yes,
the light from the upheld lamp on the landscape painting was bluish, eerie.
But this is lovely.
Italy.
1655. The ochre's beautiful, no?
The Klaus not so good, I think. Very early, though the provenance is impeccable on both. Would be nice to keep them together. They have never been apart, these two. Father and son. Came down together in an old Dutch family. Ended up in Austria after the war. Pieter Klaus.
Horst held the light higher.
Klaus was so uneven, honestly. Wonderful technique, wonderful surface, but something a bit off with this one, don't you agree? The composition doesn't hold together. Incoherent somehow.
Also, indicating with the flat of his thumb the too bright shine coming off the canvas, overly varnished.
I agree, and here,
tracing midair the ugly arc where an over-eager cleaning had scrubbed the paint down to the scumbling.
Yes.
His answering look was amiable and drowsy.
Quite correct. Acetone.